This is the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, Series 7, Episode 15. Keep the ball shiny. Coming up on this week's Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, off the back of a Twitter conversation, we talk about how you keep the ball shiny and what happens when you don't necessarily agree with each other on the best way to do that. We also answer some listeners' questions on having the front foot straight when you're bowling and generating more pace. And we talk about fielding rules in cricket. What's on, what's not on, and what's unusual but acceptable. All that and more coming up on this week's Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. It's time once again for another Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. Half an hour or so of cricket chat. Whether it's coaching or playing, we are here to give you a hand and hopefully entertain you along the way as well. And who are we? Well, my name is David Hinchliffe. I look after things here. And joining me on the line are two very fine cricket coaches. The first is the director of cricket coaching at Millfield School and major celebrity now, it seems. It's Mark Garraway. Hello, Garras.
I'm not sure about the celebrity bit. Where am I a major celebrity? Is there something I don't know about?
Oh, well, you know, you just, wherever I go, people are, you know, people nod their heads and say, yes, of course, Garras is right again.
All of them, all those people.
Yeah, no, I had a chat. We had a pre-season friendly at the weekend and one of the guys came up to me and said, I listened to the podcast. So
brilliant. Well, it's great though, isn't it? Travelling around and, you know, people who've got an interest in, you know, not necessarily learning, but at least listening to different views and maybe applying them. So yeah. I get a load of those and it's just great that we're getting out there now.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Secondly, on the line, it's the cricket professional at Portsmouth Grammar School. It's Sam Lavery. Hello, Lavers.
Hello, David. How are we doing?
Yeah, very good. You know, cricket's starting to be played, so we're very happy. And I take it you've managed to get a game on in the last week or so.
We've had a few games. We've also had a bit of snow, which I imagine you've had a bit of snow up there as well.
Yeah, a bit of sleet. Yeah.
So, yeah, yesterday was very eventful. We had an under 14 session in the afternoon, which was glorious sunshine with snow at the same time. So it was great fun. Didn't stop though. We kept going.
Our Australian import, who, as I mentioned before, thought 18 degrees was cold, was there's a picture of him playing cricket yesterday, looking out the window in astonishment as the snow fell and the covers were on. And it's the first time he's ever seen snow. So that's another tick.
Brilliant.
That's another tick in the box for him.
That is absolutely brilliant.
We had a good discussion. Well, I had a good discussion this week with a coach on Twitter who was talking about, I was mentioning an old thing that we talked about, Garras, in that shining the ball and keeping the ball dry is important to keeping the shine on the ball and getting it to swing throughout the innings as much as possible. And the discussion was based around the fact that this coach was very sceptical on that because he said in his 30 years of playing cricket, he found the opposite to be true. If you get the, you know, if you apply a bit of spit to the ball, that's what makes it work. And that made me think, okay, that's interesting because you've got stuff that's researched and you've got stuff that is in personal experience. And when they don't match up, how do you sort of come to a conclusion on where to move next? And it's not necessarily just about a dry ball or a ball that's had a little bit of spit applied to it, but it could be about anything. So we can use that as an example, but where do you go when you see one thing happening, but you've sort of heard about and you've seen research and other things happen? It's sort of, the two don't tally up, do they?
No, they don't. But I mean, that's a brilliant thing about the game in many ways, and also it's a brilliant thing about cricket ball.
Yeah.
Because it can react very differently. If we think about what a cricket ball was, you know, it was ultimately the outside of it was a cow, wasn't it? And you know, that was a living, breathing thing at some point that operated in similar ways to ourselves. And the reason why we look to try and keep it not necessarily dry. Dry is not the right way of looking at it. But we've got to be very careful about what we apply to the ball because, you know, the oils that were in the cow's skin, just as we've got them in our skin as well are still there in a cricket ball. And we've got to nurture those, because that's the thing that gets it shiny. It isn't the spit, it's the oils that we bring out through the ball, through rubbing it, that brings it to the surface, that gets that ball shiny on one side. A bit of a contrast in the ball going and doing its funny things through the air, which is exactly what we're looking for as a bowling unit. So as long as we understand that principle, whether we apply some spit to it, great, but just be wary that you're not trying to dull down those oils or dilute those oils. You're trying to bring those oils out. That's the crucial thing. So what I generally do is I get the kids to use their natural oils in their hair, because they've got more of it than me, to put it onto the ball and then work with that, because then you're adding oil into the thing, because that's the thing that actually gives us a shine. You know, Marcus Driscoffic back in 2005 would be more along the theory that your friend or the guy that you were talking to would go on, which was to put spit onto it. But of course his spit was very enhanced spit, if you remember rightly, because we were using all sorts of sweets to put sugary substance to again bring out and to enhance the natural oils of a ball. So that's the reason for it, really. Rather than saying wet or dry, it's about enhancing the naturalness of a ball.
Leavens, just taking that idea a little bit wider, when you get that, when you get something new, a new idea that comes in, and you can be strong on your opinion of it because, you know, you know that it works, but you get pushback from people who say, well, that's not the way we've done it before. How do you approach that idea? You know, what approach do you take to sort of try and introduce a new idea that might be counter to a previous one?
Yeah, I guess it can be difficult, especially if you think of the makeup of a side, because when you're playing in a match, no one person has that ownership of the ball. So if you're bowling and you've got your theory at one end, it might be that the guy down the other end has a very different theory to it, and you're actually kind of trying to do opposite things. So I'd be very aware that whatever you think you've done in your time, and things that you've done to the ball, be aware that you've only done that for the time you've been hold of the ball, and lots of other people have held it, lots of other people have polished it, lots of other people have bowled with it during that game or during that net session or during that season or whatever it might be. So first of all, we've just got to be quite realistic about how their experiences are assessed. They've done something that's worked for them. That might be that it's purely a result of their wrist position, or purely a result of what the guy at the other end has done, or purely a result of the conditions they play in a lot of the time. So I think if people come to a conversation with an attitude that they've got the magic answer and there's nothing else that could possibly work, they've probably got to have their eyes opened a little bit to make them aware that there are a few more factors involved than what they've done and simply what they apply in terms of what they're doing to the ball. Once you've got to the situation where you've maybe got that and you're trying to introduce them to something else, it's probably picking your moments and pricking your time and also challenging them. So maybe give them an opportunity to try and unearth something new. So even if you've got something that you'd like to bring in and you want them to try and start shining the ball without saliva or with saliva or whatever it might be, then make it a challenge to them. So give them a quest as the leader of the attack. So there's someone who's in charge of the group, and I want them to take a bit of ownership and a bit of control of it and see if there's a way we can shine a ball if it gets wet, because ultimately sometimes that will happen. Or we can shine a ball without using the sweat from our forehead or whatever it might be, because again, sometimes on a day we may not be able to do that. So probably give them an opportunity as a challenge, and give them a bit of acknowledgement to what they already do and what they already know, and then see if they can add to what they do and look at it on them developing the people around them and developing the ball within the team, rather than just trying to say, this doesn't work, I don't believe you, let's do something different, because that's probably not going to go very far.
You can always set up tests, can't you, in your own, you know, whilst the research that we look at, it comes out of laboratories and all of that sort of malarkey. But there's no harm in, you know, on a wet evening or whatever, getting two cricket balls out that look pretty similar, giving it to two people that have got contrasting views, and getting them to work on it. You can even do that in a net session.
Yeah.
You know, let's have a net over here, this net over here with our three seamers over this side. You're the trial group that's going to look at shining the ball using the method that I've talked about here. And then the other group are going to be using the method that the other fella talks about. And let's see what happens.
And that way you can come to your own conclusion, then, can't you? And then say, well, you know, we've tried it and everybody can see the results. Let's do it this way from now on. And then it doesn't become about, you know, a competition or anything. It just comes about, let's see what works best for us.
Absolutely right. And, you know, that's a pretty good way of going about some stuff in your own environment around all sorts of questions and differences in opinion is to give it a go, do your own test. And your results might not be globally right, but if it works within your environment, everybody believes that and you go for it and you have success with it, then fantastic. You know, as Graham Thorpe talks about, a good technique is whatever gets the job done.
Yes.
You know, and in your world, that might get the job done better than the way that I've suggested. And if that's the case, fill your boots.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. Yeah, we were talking about that last night with a new player who said he scored 49 on the weekend in 43 balls. When everyone else was scratching around at a strike rate of about 50, he just came in and scored very freely, no bother at all. And you know, I was talking to him about that, and he said, "Oh yeah," he said, "my technique isn't very good." And by the way, it's fine, but he thinks it's not very good. And I said to him, "Well, look, you know, you absolutely got the job done when everybody else was scratching around to, you know, to get to 25. You hit 50 in no time, so I shouldn't worry about it. It's working."
Yeah, no, I'm a big believer in that. You know, and obviously there are do your own tests. That's all I'd say to you. Certainly playing at Ventnor Cricket Club, we all had ways that we were going to win home games because we used our bowl to our advantage as a cricket team. You know, and so we all knew how to go about it. We tested different methods, maybe not in a formalised way, but we did over a period of time and we came up with our method. And it was a very successful one. And it's the same principle. So, you know, just because we say something works, if you don't agree with it, then test it out. It might be proven wrong, or equally, you might be proven right in your own environment. And that's really important.
OK, let's wrap up this section with the yes-no round. Three questions that can only be answered yes or no, no matter how much more the team want to say. I've got the questions, so let's fire away. First question, success is failure repeated?
No.
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 Second question, throwing technique is as important as batting technique?
Yes.
Yes.
Third question, great cricketers are adaptable cricketers?
Yes.
Yes.
Now let's head into the mailbag section of the show. We take questions that have been sent in by listeners to this show or readers to the Pitch Vision website, and we attempt to answer those questions as best we can, and we pick a prize winner at the end when they get an online coaching course from Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. And you can send your questions into us by emailing coach@pitchvision.com. And Piers is the first person to have done that this week, and Piers says, "Hi, I'm having problems with my front foot not 100% landing straight when bowling. Although this is not causing any injuries, it's preventing my front leg being braced. How can I change this?"
Yes, it's a good question. I'd be interested to know which way it's not going straight, if that makes sense. You know, which way is it pointing? Does it do a little bit of a Jimmy Anderson and just open up a little bit? Or does it do a bit of a Freddie Flintoff where it used to close on the front? In Jimmy's case, it hasn't caused him injury problems, a bit like yourself. He was able to get over a straight front leg. And I wonder if... your foot position is actually the main root cause of whether you can't get over a straight front leg or not. You know, what I'd be interested to look at how your heel is landing, if you're getting a heel contact or if you're having a midfoot or front of your foot contact on the floor. Because obviously, if we use that heel to toe contact and we go across a full range of our foot plate, then we can absorb the force and use the force better, which means that we'll probably be able to bowl over our straighter front leg than the one that you're experiencing at the moment. So it's not just about the alignment of the foot would be my thing. Yeah, you know, there are other things that come into play as well about which way your force is aligned from your back foot contact, in fact, from your bound into your back foot contact, into your front foot contact as well, which can have a bearing on the classification of that front leg. So there could be a number of things, but Jimmy Anderson's a great example of somebody who bowls over a braced front leg with that open foot. Fred bowled over a braced front leg with a closed foot as well. So it's not always down to the alignment of the foot, which is the root cause. So again, you know, we always say it, but if we could see it, then we would probably have a good idea. But one of the main ones is not getting a heel-to-toe contact. So going through the full range of that foot plate does have a real good effect when trying to absorb the force of the ground and then using it up the kinetic chain and into the back of the ball.
So, Levers, if we take the goal as trying to get the front leg braced, and we assume that having a slight misalignment of the front foot is not going to cause too much of a problem, what kind of things can he do to get that front leg more braced safely?
Okay, well, I agree with Gareth there, and I think that if you have the full foot contact with the floor as you're landing with that front foot, then you've probably got a better chance, and you're probably more likely to be finding a straighter front leg or brace your front leg. I've actually got a bit of a theory on this that I've worked with a little bit this winter, and it's a very small sample size of two bowlers, so I'm not going to be announcing it as gospel at any time soon. However, one of the things that I've seen that encourages people to land heel first, and that subsequently doesn't necessarily help all the time with getting that front leg straight, is driving their knees a little bit further and a little bit higher. So you imagine the higher you drive your knee, the more you're going to like to show your foot towards the bowler, and the more likely potentially you are for have heel contact rather than flat contact. So if you can picture that, you've got someone who's driving with their heel down towards the floor rather than with their sole of the foot down towards the floor. So to try and adjust this, what we've done is we've actually jumped with a straighter right leg, which subsequently has made a slightly straighter left leg. And subsequently, we've had more sole down towards the floor. And that's helped actually quite a lot in keeping that front leg straight. It's helped with two people, so whether or not it's something that can be reproduced across a lot more people, difficult to say at this stage, but it's something we tried. A couple of people I've looked at in kind of thinking about this, and quite good examples are Liam Plunkett, who's a pretty good example of someone who doesn't necessarily have a big knee drive into his jumps, and his legs stay fairly straight. And also one of his teammates at Yorkshire, Steve Patterson, who got some runs the other day, which he'd be very happy about. Equally jumps with a reasonably straight leg, right leg into his jump, and his left leg stays fairly straight through it. So they're both quite flat through the jump, but as a result, they do quite well with the energy they produce from their action, especially Pato, who's not overly fast, but has managed to maintain himself being quite consistent, as well as locking that leg pretty well, without a whole lot of effort through the action, from what I can see and conversations I've had with him.
And would you make a change like that by starting from a specific point in the action, starting from the jump or somewhere like that, and work, and then building it back up?
Well, again, it's something I've done twice. So one of the boys managed to pick it up quite quickly and was quite happy to try and go straight from a jogging approach. And from that jogging approach, he actually managed to kind of adapt quite quickly, changing the way he was jumping, and that worked quite well for him. And he liked it straight away. The other boy I've tried it with didn't actually quite find it quite so easy, and it became a lot more drawn out. It was something we started back in November, and it probably took him a good 4 or 5 weeks before he was quite comfortable running in and starting to get that slight improvement with it. So I guess it's going to be, with a lot of these things, horses for courses. So working out where people want to start and how people have that kind of body awareness and control of what they're doing. But there's no reason it can't start from sort of ground point and making sure that we go through a walking approach through it first of all and try and get a feeling of that straight leg and then gradually feed it all the way back. Whereas equally, there's no point. You can't throw the idea at someone and see if they can do it from their full run-up and let them get on with it themselves.
Of course, we've got to remember that having a straight front leg is not a deal breaker of whether you're going to be a good bowler or not. You know, because there's been plenty of unreal bowlers who are still operating in the world, have operated down the world, around the world over the years, and demonstrated different knee classifications. And one of the things that we've got to be aware of is that whilst having a braced front leg is fantastic for throwing energy up the kinetic chain into the hips and up through the torso, into the arms, and then the back of the ball, there is a potential injury injury payoff for that, because the best one for having an absorbing the force, using it well but in a healthy context, is to have a slight bend, sort of like a bend, so you're absorbing the first impact and then extending, so you're then shoving up the energy through the body. So you know, you look at somebody like Dale Steyn is somebody who doesn't bowl consistently over a braced front leg, but I think all of us would take his stats and his performance.
I think that's where there's obviously a bit of an S&C slant to it as well, isn't there, in trying to increase that lower body strength. So even if people aren't landing completely straight, they can definitely try and resist the forces going through and, as you said, get the energy going up through the body and out the arm. And with a slightly stronger lower body, then you're increasing your chance of being able to do so, as opposed to kind of just focusing on the technical side and not worrying too much about the physicality of it.
Next question is from Manu, and it's quite a specific question, but I thought perhaps we could use it as a jumping off point for something wider. So he says, "Hi Pitch Vision, I want to know about fielding rules in cricket. Can we put a fielder in any position? Like, for example, I put one fielder at mid-off and then I also put one behind mid-off at long-off. Is there any rule against that in cricket?" So let's start with that specific question, but let's broaden that on, say, what kind of unusual fields have you seen that have worked in what kind of situations? That might be a little bit more interesting than just answering yes or no to that question. But let's start by answering that question.
Firstly, great field. I love it. Really, really good field. In fact, I saw a game played the other day on a wicket where that field would have been unbelievable. It'd have been really successful because you'd have the guys that were popping the ball up off a slow deck to normal mid-off, and then a few cottoned on later in the innings and decided that if it was going to pop, then they were going to commit to it. So if you got two in place, then you got two opportunities of a catch. So there's a great example. It would have been rubbish at me because I never hit it to mid-off anyway. So if you had two fielders there, that was more gaps for me elsewhere. But I love that as an idea. Malcolm Marshall used to set bouncer fields on slower decks. He'd bowl a bouncer with a guy at normal square leg and a guy at square leg just in front of square on the boundary. So he had two options, for the one that was hit flat for a catch and also the top edge, or the one that was hit high for a catch. So, you know, you can do pretty much whatever you want within the game. Obviously, the only fielding restrictions that we are aware of is those ones about close fielding to junior cricket and stuff like that. But I love the question. I love the fact that you tried that, and I'd have been fascinated. Did you get a wicket with it?
Yeah, it would be interesting to find out. Of course, thanks to Don Bradman, you can't put three behind square on the leg side. That is ingrained in the laws of the game. And then there are certain...
Thank goodness. Yeah. That's all I say. Thank goodness for that.
Yeah. And there are certain other restrictions in different competitions. But yeah, that's more to do with the inside or outside the fielding circle, isn't it? Rather than having two players in roughly the same position. Lavers, have you ever seen any fields that have been successful where you've got two fielders where they wouldn't normally be?
Well, yeah, not necessarily successful, but I think quite a famous one is Brendan McCullum playing towards the end of his career when he would bat and there would be a slip to him, possibly a gully, then there would be someone floating halfway, and then there'd be someone on the point boundary and someone on the third man boundary, and you'd suddenly find that there were probably five or six players all covering a very similar angle but various different positions and distances, and while it was a great idea and you can see the theory behind it, they still forgot to put someone four rows back and it didn't work too often. So I guess there are some obvious fields that people will have, and putting one behind the other often seems like a silly thing to do, but if you're in a position where it seems to make sense and the two are different, completely different shots, an example of that would be if you've got a short leg or a silly point, you'd often disregard them if you're a fielder in the ring, because if someone goes to push a one, just because you're behind them doesn't mean they're going to stop the ball. So I think the close catches are often disregarded when setting up your ring field, so there's no reason why you wouldn't have one behind the other there. Having it on the leg side is often a common thing as well, where you might see one behind the other simply for one shot, which is an aerial shot, and the other one where they're still trying to work a single, and you might not line them up perfectly, but I can't see any reason why it wouldn't happen if you know the guy's strengths and you know where they want to hit the ball.
To me, the reason why we've got to the stage where we have fields set like we do, conventional fields, is because we've always looked at the game in a 2D fashion. You know, we've always looked at it in the coaching manuals where you plot the field, don't you, on a flat bit of paper or in the book or on a whiteboard. But actually, in reality, and more so now than any other stage in the game is played in a 3D fashion. The game is played a lot like the bird's eye view looking down on a game of cricket, where space is the important thing, as opposed to line, which is all we're looking at when we're plotting a 2D field. So, I reckon it's so relevant. And as I say, on Saturday, the game we played on a slow wicket, it'd have been perfect to have a mid-off and a deep mid-off, because then you've got two catching opportunities. The ball's likely to go straight down the ground because of the pace of the pitch. And why not? That would have been an example of a 3D field that you set the other day, as opposed to a 2D field.
We once, in a game that I was playing, we once set a very, very straight mid-off. So straight that he drifted a little bit, and he was standing behind the bowler's arm when he was bowling, and the batsman complained. He said, well, there's no point in having the sights because there's a bloke wandering around behind there. So we had to... That's where he's hitting it was the problem. So... So we had to move across a little bit and stop him wandering around.
Yeah, that's fair enough. But there you go. So there is somewhere you can't field. I like it.
Yeah, exactly. Like directly it. Behind the bowler's arm. That's not on. Especially when you're waving your hands around going, miss it. That's, you can't do that, apparently. Time now for the soapbox. It's Sam Lavery. It's 60 seconds. He's got to do it quick. Over to you, Lavers.
Okay, all I wanted to think about really was how we get people on the side of the pitch to support those people on the pitch. And being involved in school cricket a lot of the time, you see lots and lots of kids on the side of the on the side of the pitch, and they're cheering and shouting, which is brilliant. And then you see other kids who are off playing in the nets, and they're doing their own thing equally, which is brilliant. So I was at a game recently where there was a strict rule for the team that the opposition had to sit on a bench, and I thought, it's a nice idea, but is that detrimental to the experience of the boys? Equally, I saw another one where all the boys had to train all the way through the game, which I've seen a couple of times over the last year or so. So I think it's quite a good talking point for the boys involved, or the girls involved, and all of those coaching staff who are making up the numbers in terms of decisions, and just think, what do we want people doing at matches? How much support or cheering or whatever it is do we need? How much practice time do we need? And can we come up with a rule that fits all, so everyone knows what's expected of them on the match day?
And that is the end of this week's show. There is a couple more things we need to do before we leave. The first of those things is to decide on the winner of this week's competition prize, the online coaching course from Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. It was two questions, one from Piers about his front foot not landing straight, and the other from Monu about fielding rules in cricket. Which one did you prefer this week, Gareth?
Well, two absolute legendary questions. Got us talking a lot, so well done on that, gents. I'm going to go with the fielding one this week because we've never had anything like that before. It was nice to have it. And well done on being a 3D field setter.
Yeah, fantastic. Okay, well done, Monu. Congratulations to you. And Gareth, if someone was listening to the show who wasn't Monu and wanted to win that prize and certainly get their chance to have the question answered, how could they get in touch with us?
They could give us a call, David, on 0203 239 7543 or drop us an email on coach@pitchvision.com.
That's correct. Our Twitter is at pitchvisionacad, and you can find us on Facebook by going to facebook.com/pitchvisionacademy. You can listen to this show every week if you want to do that by searching for us in your favourite podcast app, or you can go to the Pitch Vision website, pitchvision.com/academy. Click on the podcast link and you get all the show notes there. You can stream the show live, download it, do whatever you want to do if you want to do that through the website as well. That's all for this week. We hope you listen next week. But until then, have a good week. Cheers, Gareth. Cheers, Lavers.
Cheers, fellas.